Market Music with Fairbairn and Russell.
Welcome to the Market Musings podcast, and today on the podcast we welcome a guest from a sector that we've not mused over before, as we welcome Ben Habib, the Group Chief Executive of First Property Group, also known as FPRO. Now, they are listed on the London Stock Exchange, and the company is a property fund manager and investor with operations in the United Kingdom, Poland and Romania. So, hello Ben.
Hi Mark.
And how are you doing?
Well, as well as I can be, I suppose, in these COVID times. But no, very well, thank you, Mark.
Where are you? Where are you at the minute? Where are you? What's your location?
Well, I'm in my office, which is where I have spent every day since lockdown started. Because actually, no one else is in my office, so I've got the run of the place. And being a sort of small business, someone's got to be around to sign contracts and make payments and stuff like that. So I am in my office, and it keeps me sane, actually, you know, working from an office.
So when you say you haven't left, have you slept there as well, or has it not got to that stage?
No. I've been coming in. I've been behaving as if life is normal.
Okay.
Except, you know, I've been Boris biking in. Or running, and and then working a normal day.
Cool. And it's London, is it? Is that where you are?
It's London, yeah. St. James Street, yeah.
And what's it like in London? Is it a bit surreal?
Well, it was very surreal to start with. Traffic, funny enough, is picking up. And I say this morning, it's not back to rush hour kind of levels. But, you know, with a bit of road work going on, you sort of feel like London is beginning to ignore the lockdown. Mm. To start with, St. James's Street, Piccadilly, was like a ghost town, as you might expect it to be. You wouldn't even expect it to be like this at 5 a.m. You know, it's busier at 5 a.m. typically than it has been. But I can sense that Londoners are beginning to, you know, get back to work and slightly ignore the lockdown.
I think that is happening generally. I mean, I'm based in York, and I can tell over the last week that traffic has definitely picked up on the roads. It's still quiet, particularly on the weekends. It's very quiet, but that does suggest that it's people who perhaps need to go to work. And, you know, there are people that do need to, you know, just the nature of their jobs.
We all need to.
Well, but some of us can get away with it from home. I think that's the other thing. Like, I can get away with it from home.
I see what you're saying.
But some can't. So yeah, you're probably right. Lockdown rules are being flouted a little bit, but no doubt we'll hear the government advice in the next, is it a week or two? How are they going to plan to?
7th of May, I think, is the target date.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll see.
Good stuff. Hi Ben, it's Kenny here.
Hi Kenny.
Just before we go into obviously First Property, I always like to delve into your past, you know, what you've done in business, you know, what you've done in your life. You can go back as far as you want, you know, maybe your family, early childhood, schooling, you know, what university you went to. It's just good to get a bit of background, if you don't mind giving us that.
No, sure, very happy to do that. So I'm half Pakistani and half English, as my name might suggest. My dad was born in Punjab. My mother was born in Isleworth, just outside London. I was myself born in Karachi in 1965. I spent my first few years in Karachi until I was 13. My parents sent me to boarding school in 1979 when Bhutto had been arrested and there was a coup and schools in Pakistan were closed for sort of 9 months, so they decided to get all three children out of the country at the same time. I came to rugby school where I boarded until, you know, I did my A-levels there, and then I went to Cambridge University, studied natural sciences, specializing in organic chemistry. And then, as you'd expect every natural scientist to do, I joined the city in 1987, working for what was called Sherson Lehman Brothers in those days, but more infamously came to be known as Lehman Brothers. And I've had a career in finance and property ever since, starting my own business in partnership with one other guy in 1994. And then I started First Property Group in the year 2000, and I've run first property ever since.
Yeah, that must have been quite interesting coming from, was it quite a large family you came from, Ben?
Well, no, my dad was born in a very poor family, actually, in Punjab. And he was the only one of his, I think, 8 siblings to be university educated. But he worked extremely hard and he became managing director of what was then called Burroughs Wellcome, and then became Wellcome PLC and then got swallowed up into Glaxo. But it was as a result of his hard work that he could afford to send me to boarding school and my siblings. And, you know, he still lives in Pakistan. Thankfully, he's, with the good grace of God, he's still alive, 86 years old. My mum lives in England and she too is alive. But that, you know, so, you know, we come from a humble background, but, you know, greatly privileged to have had that boarding school education.
Yeah, certainly seems to have set you up well. So moving on to then to sort of first property. I mean, before we get into sort of detail, can you give me an overview of the investment strategy and what?
Yeah, sure. So I come to property not as a property specialist, but as a financier, having, you know, been a scientist and therefore numerically orientated, and then at Lehman Brothers in finance, and then I was finance director of another company for a few years. So I come to property as a financier, and I see property as an asset class through which you can make money. And so I'm not an RICS qualified property operator. It's also very important to note that I come at it from a proprietarial perspective rather than from an advisory perspective. So all the deals that I did in the 90s, I did out of my own pocket. And I think that gives you a very different approach to ownership and management than if you've done it as an advisor all your life. You know, I think you have a much keener acknowledgement of the importance of capital preservation over the pursuit of returns. And in many respects, you know, I've had a sort of pedestrian career as a result of that, because I haven't taken big risks when other people have been prepared to do so. But the flip side of that is that, you know, we had a very good, in fact, I've now been through 3 recessions in my time in property. And every time, you know, we've come through it well and we've come through it profitably. And we came in, you know, through the 2008 financial credit crunch extremely well. In fact, since 2007, First Property Group, which I run, has had a cumulative annual growth in net assets of 25% per annum. You know, not many companies, if any, in the property industry can boast that kind of return from the peak of the last boom to the current position. Remains to be seen how we navigate COVID. But, it's quite, you know, it's a really good track record. And I think it comes from being proprietarial, understanding what it means to lose money, and therefore putting capital preservation high up on my agenda.
Mm-hmm. And throughout all those years, you've always managed to pay a dividend as well, even during the recessions.
We have. We've either maintained or increased our dividend throughout the post-credit crunch period. And I think that does put us in a kind of unique position. Most property companies had to do rights issues to survive. You know, we actually didn't have to raise any money, and we've been paying increasing dividends to our shareholders.
Yeah, that's unheard of almost in these challenging times. So commercial property, can you break it down into what kind of sector within the sort of commercial property market you guys are into?
So just to give you some, I might just reverse back a little bit from there, Ken, just to say you've got some proper background. So we are a co-investing commercial property fund manager. And what that means is that we use some of our own cash to put alongside our clients' cash. And typically we'll do that in a sort of 10% to 90% ratio. And then we will use the 100 quid that we've got to keep the math simple, to go and buy a property. And we can either do that with bank debt as well. So the hundred pounds then has £300 worth of buying power typically. Or we can do that without leverage, or you know, a smaller amount of leverage. But typically, our sort of 10 quid that we put into a deal would give us somewhere between £200 and £300 of buying power. And that's our sort of business model, a co-investing fund manager. And we make our money by charging a fee on the funds that we manage, and also a rate of return on our own investment that we have in the fund. And it's a model that's worked very well because it allows us to magnify the returns on our own equity through marrying up with third-party equity and then magnifying it again through bank debt. But also it keeps us firmly focused on that proprietarial nature of investment because we've got our own skin in the game and material skin in the game. You know, we're not putting a tuppence up in order to show willing. We're putting serious money into each deal. And we started our fund management activities in 2002. We've now got about 700 million under management, and about 150 million or so of that is on our balance sheet.
And so, as you say, it's commercial property, is a sort of retail parks, office space, that kind of idea? Or?
We are mostly offices, which, bearing COVID in mind, bearing everything in mind, over the last few years, has been a good place to be. We do have some retail. To the extent that we've got retail, it's mostly retail warehousing and focused on the discount retail sector. So we've been much more interested in buying things like Poundland, B&M. We've got B&Q as well, which has been a very good trader. We typically haven't bought into high street retail or shopping centers. We have a couple of shopping centers in Poland, which have done very well, until recently anyway. Can I just say that everything I talk about in terms of history is COVID-19 aside. So far, you know, we've done well to steer clear mostly of the riskier end of the retail market. And to the extent we've had retail, it's actually performed reasonably well.
I mean, just when you're talking about surviving the COVID situation, these are pretty well cashed up because there was a recent sale in Poland on an office block that brought some money into the business.
Yeah, so one of the odd things about the credit crunch and the stimulus that followed it was that, you know, it pushed up asset values quite a lot. And that sort of carry trade, borrowing in euros and investing in zlotys on higher income denominated zloty investments, is something that's gone on for years. And last year, I just kind of felt the market in Poland was getting a bit toppy. And we had an offer for our largest asset, an office tower in central Warsaw, which we accepted. And we exchanged contracts to sell it in December. And I have to say, I was slightly in two minds when we were selling it because I was thinking we're giving up a really good income stream. But I felt the market was toppy and we should take the bid. And that has resulted in our now having £25 million cash sitting on our balance sheet, which is a terrific way to go in. I mean, no one could have foreseen this pandemic and the economic meltdown that it will cause. But it's a terrific way to go into an economic meltdown because we've got real firepower to both protect our interests and our shareholders' interests as we go through the difficult period, but also to buy up cheap assets, which inevitably there will be, you know, towards the end of the pandemic economic recession.
What you were saying as well, you're £10, you can typically buy you £300. So, you know, 25 million can go a long way.
It can. I mean, let's assume we want to keep a reserve of 5 million and let's say we don't do as much leverage as we might normally do, but it gives us somewhere near 400 million worth of buying power, you know, and there will be leverage available. You know, if the last credit crunch is anything to go by, what will happen is that initially asset values will drop, income will drop as tenants get into difficulties. That will then stabilize over a year or two. Income levels will be at a depressed level. Trade will begin to pick up, but stimulus will keep asset values stable and then rising. And we need to buy into that sort of troughish period when income is down and asset values have fallen but begun to stabilize. And then ultra low interest rates, from which I don't think we will now be able to escape for years and years and years. Ultra low interest rates will push up asset values. We'll get asset price inflation, which all the central banks will ignore. And people who are able to buy property down in that trough period, I think will do incredibly well.
It sounds an interesting times ahead. And so as well as Poland, it's Romania and the UK. That's your sort of three demographic sectors.
Yeah, they are. And I think we'll kind of stick to that. There's enough opportunity in those three markets to keep ourselves busy. We have a philosophy, Kenny, of managing all the property we own. We don't like doing it in joint venture. We don't like subcontracting our management obligations. We like to employ people that are, you know, 100% dedicated to our properties. And so, you know, by that, as a result of that philosophy and policy, we don't want to spread ourselves too thinly. You know, I know just about every tenancy schedule of every property that we own or manage. And so, you know, and I don't want to lose that grip. It allows, you know, it allows us to be very nimble and capable. And so, you know, just addressing your point, we're very happy with sticking with the UK, Poland and Romania.
On the properties, Ben, do you at which point do you get involved? Are you buying completed properties? Are you buying on a plot or a plan? Do you get involved with the construction of the property at all or not? How does it work in terms of actually acquiring?
Yeah, so I've got during the 90s, I did a lot of property development, but the fund management industry is best suited to income producing property. So what we've typically been buying is standing assets, which are income producing. And our basic approach has been to buy high yielding assets. And by that, I mean assets which produce a yield on the purchase price, which is well north of the cost of borrowing, because we leverage up against our assets. You know, there's got to be good headroom between the cost of funding our debt and the yield that the property generates, so that we are able to service the interest, pay our taxes, amortize our debt, and still have enough of an income left over to pay our clients a healthy dividend. And actually, that discipline has been very important, because as values rise and yields drop, for example, as it did in 2005 to 2007, you know, we weren't able to make our numbers stack up in the UK. And that prompted us to sell all our UK assets. And so when the credit crunch hit back in 2008, we were out of the UK pretty much. And that's why we had such a stellar performance in the credit crunch years. It was the pursuit of high-yielding income streams and staying true to our policy of not investing in low-yielding income streams that prompted us to sell and kept us out of the market when the market was collapsing. So we went into 2008 with a high cash balance, and we're going into this COVID-19 pandemic with a high cash balance as well.
Yeah, so you're obviously in you're in a strong position, as you say, to take advantage of what potentially is coming. And so the income, forgive me for the silly question, the income presumably comes from rents from the properties you own, and also the value of the property increasing over time.
Exactly. So our revenue for our clients and ourselves comes from rental income mostly. If you look back at any long-term period in any property market, whether it's the UK, Poland, anywhere else, the US, over a 30-year period, 85 to 90% of your returns come from income. They don't come from capital gain.
Sure.
And because we're kind of long-term owners of property, we focus much more on the resilience of income streams and rent levels. And it's one of the reasons we're drawn to discount retailers, for example, because the rent level is quite low, but the yield at which you can buy those properties is quite high. So it ticks both of our fundamental boxes of being a sustainable rent level, but actually being a high-yielding property. And it's a simple model. You know, it's so simple to articulate, and we've done very well out of it over time. What is interesting, though, is you can take a company like Great Portland Estates, which specializes in West End London property. And theirs is a completely capital play. And when capital values are rising, as they have done in London over the last 10 years quite dramatically, you know, Great Portland Estates looks amazingly clever and has done incredibly well, and all credit to their management team. But actually, when values drop, as I think they will now, mm-hmm. you will see, you know, quite a reversal in their fortunes. Whereas the reversal you'll see in our portfolio will be much less marked, because, you know, we're not sitting on a highly high value, low income producing properties. And just to put that into mathematical terms, Mark, so mm-hmm. it's clear, you know, if you buy a property yielding 3.5%, mm-hmm. and that yield moves out to 4%, to keep the math simple, actually, you've lost something like 15% of value. Whereas if you buy a property on a 9% yield and it moves out to 9.9%, you've only lost 10% of value. Mm-hmm. Or if it moves out the equivalent 0.5% yield, you've only lost 5% in value. You've got a much bigger capital value cushion when you buy high yielding property than you have when you buy low yielding property. And buying into prime markets like London exposes you to very sharp capital value movements. And you feel very clever when values are rising, but you know, you get whipped when capital values drop. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Just explain what you mean by yield.
So yield is the rent that you get on a property divided by the price that you pay for it. Okay. And in London, the yield is, you know, roughly around 3.5% at the moment, right. Or was before COVID kicked off. And, you know, in Poland, we can buy stuff at 8-9%, no trouble.
Okay.
And so we have that yield protection. Our capital value movements are cushioned by yield. What that does mean is that when capital values are rising, you don't get the same dramatic gain. But it means that it also means that when capital values are falling, you don't get that same dramatic drop. And that yield cushions you. And if you go back to what I said earlier, which okay. is that over the long term, it's income that produces your return. Mm. You know, over the long term, and we're long-term owners of property, we do well.
Yeah, and you said as the yield goes up, what is that when you lose the value?
Well, yes, capital values drop, yields go up, you know. And so if you take my example, let's say capital values drop by 10%. In our case, the yield will go from 9 to 9.9%. In Great yeah. Portland Estates portfolio, it might go from 3 to 3.3%. You know, a much smaller movement in interest rates will clobber the lower yielding properties much more than it'll clobber the higher yielding properties. I'm probably not making that clear, but let me. I think it's worth focusing on this, if you don't mind me focusing.
Yeah,
on
absolutely.
It
yeah, it could be me just yeah. being thick as well. I don't know.
Yeah. So interest rates at the moment, base rates are 0.1%.
Yeah.
If the Bank of England were to raise them to 0.5%, that's a 0.4% increase in interest rates. Mm-hmm. You'd expect the yield on a 3% property to go from 3% to 3.4%. Mm-hmm. And you'd expect the yield on one of our properties to go from 8% to 8.4%. But the capital value movement as a result of that shift in yield is much less pronounced on the higher yielding property. On the lower yielding property, 3% to 3.4% is more like a 12% reduction in capital values.
Oh, I see.
But on our profit, on our property at 8%, it's a 5% movement in capital value. So it's less than half the adverse movement. And so we're much less prone to capital value shift.
And yeah, I understand that. So you, and when you disposed of your Poland asset, that was yeah. because, is that because you felt that the rental market was becoming a little, as you said, toppy, or you know, you could say something?
No, because the capital values have gone too high.
Oh, of the property, right, okay.
Of the property,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there was a lot of demand for property around Poland in 07. Prime property in 07 reached a peak of around 6.5% for office blocks. Prime okay. property pre-COVID, prime property prices in Warsaw were down at about 4.5%. And that said to me that we're in really toppy grounds.
So your prediction might be then that that Poland asset, you perhaps sold it at a high price, and it's more, in your opinion, it's likely to fall.
Yeah, it should fall. It'll fall in value, I think, over the next 6 to 12 months. It may then pick up back to the price that they paid for it.
Right,
because of sustained low interest rates and government quantitative easing and so on.
Yeah.
But, you know, right now, I think it was a good call to sell it.
Yeah. And I know you you say, you know, this COVID situation is still in the early stages, but have you seen any sort of problems with like your rental income? I just know that
absolutely.
You have, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have. I mean, shopping centers in Poland were forcibly closed by the government. Retail in this country has been forcibly closed.
Yes.
Restaurants have been closed, so tenants are unable to pay rent.
Yes.
You know, and most leisure or retail, obviously there's some very big players as well with proper balance sheets, but even the large retail occupiers of space don't have very strong balance sheets.
Yeah.
And the minute they can't trade, they can't afford to sustain rent levels. So, you know, I cannot tell you, I think, overestimate or over-exaggerate, the damage that this economic lockdown has done to the welfare of tenants across the board, but particularly the retail sector.
Yeah, of course. And from a landlord point of view, does your strong balance sheet protect you from this loss of rental income?
It does. And thankfully, the banks understand it too. So where we've got leverage on our shopping centres in Poland, the banks have been immediately, unlike 2008, where the banks actually sat on their hands and said, no, you know, we're going to force you to honour your covenants and we're going to hold your feet to the fire. Actually, the banks this time get it. And you know, the banks have been very compliant and immediately agreeable to waiving debt repayment requirements and, you know, accruing interest rather than levying it.
Yeah.
You know, so we've had a much more sensible approach from the financing markets so far. But, you know, no economy can take much of this lockdown.
No.
And 1 month, as you know, 1 month has added 10% to the UK's government's debt level.
Yeah.
And, you know, another month or two and we're going to start seeing, well, we are going to see, actually, we are going to see sovereign debt crises. And that's going to have another wave of adverse economic effect in the second half of 2020, early 2021. So, I mean, I think this recession is going to be huge.
Yeah, I was just wanting to have a chat about the market cap of First Property as well. And so you've got 25 million cash, your income streams post-COVID, the market cap's only 40 million. There's opportunities there.
I think our market cap is completely wrong. I'm quite a cautious fellow, generally, and I very rarely speak out about our share price. But I think to have a market cap of 40 million or whatever it is today, and 25 million of that in cash, when we've got assets under management of 700 million, just doesn't make any sense. It's valuing our entire business at 15 million quid, you know, and we're in a position to pay our dividend. We're in a position to take advantage of opportunities when they arise, and our profits actually should grow from here. I know that I've talked about this being the worst recession. You know, it'll be worse than 2008, but actually because we're cashed up, we should be fine. We will have some hits. Profitability will be under pressure for the next 12 months, but we'll come through it. And our asset base, together with our earnings capability, far exceed the market cap that we've currently got.
Yeah. So, I mean, we ask this to all our guests, Ben, and obviously it's hard to give us a roadmap for the next year because of the COVID situation. Obviously, your roadmap before COVID is obviously different to the roadmap after COVID. Where do you see the company going in the next year?
So, I mean, the first part of the next 12 months is going to involve dealing with tenants, settling tenants, establishing where the economic fallout is, making sure that tenants don't use this as an opportunity to rip us off. We're very sympathetic to tenants' needs, and we understand that they've got to have some kind of rent holiday, some sort of ability to trade through this. But we've got to make sure that they aren't using it as an excuse to, you know, take us to the cleaners. You know, so the first 6 months at least is going to be spent doing that kind of activity. We'll be looking at opportunities to buy, but I doubt we'll be buying anything in the next 6 months because it's too early to know how far the fall in values is going to be. You know, what we don't want to do is catch a falling knife.
Yeah. And yeah, makes sense.
So we're going to be managing our portfolio, settling our tenants, watching the market. And then I think once we feel that income levels have settled, that the full extent of the recession is clear, you know, then I think we'll be more expansive with our cash resource and be actively looking to buy.
All right. Yeah, that's a good summary. Can I just say, just personally with your, yourself, a little birdie told me that you had a stint as an MEP.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, for the Brexit Party.
Yeah. Do you want to give us an overview of how that happened?
Yeah, so I've been politically aware but politically inactive all my life. I was a Eurosceptic, and I wouldn't say I was a sort of particularly ardent Eurosceptic. I would have been quite happy to stay in the European Union if they were capable of being reformed. But when the referendum was called, and then I started reading all the output from George Osborne and Mark Carney and all the sort of Project Fear nonsense that they were spouting, I became quite engaged with the whole Brexit thing. And that involved, in those days, just writing articles and letters to the FT and Telegraph and so on. And then when the referendum was won, I was, you know, I thought that was it. And Theresa May spoke incredibly well on the steps of Downing Street. Then her Lancaster House speech was superb. And I thought, you know, Brexit would just be delivered. And I went on running First Property Group. And I was a Tory donor, so I had the benefit of going to their lunches and things in June 2018. And it was really then, listening to people like Michael Gove and others, that I realized that they're not serious about Brexit, that they had no deal plan for the United Kingdom. You know, as a CEO of a company, I would have prepared the United Kingdom for a no deal scenario, because I know that having prepared for no deal, we would have then got the best possible deal. And if we didn't, we would have been fine, because I would have prepared for that eventuality. But it became clear to me, speaking to cabinet ministers, actually, that they hadn't prepared for no deal, and that they had no intention of preparing for no deal, and that they were all laboring under the illusion that we'd get a good deal. And why the EU would give us a good deal on our exit just, you know, beggared belief. So I became incredibly upset with the Conservative Party during the course of 2018. And by the time we got to March 2019, I was ripping my hair out. And someone said, do you want to meet Nigel Farage? He's setting up something called the Brexit Party. And I thought, well, I'll, you know, the public persona of Nigel through mainstream media wasn't brilliant, but I thought I would go and see him. And I found him to be an incredibly capable, well-versed, reasonable man. And we had a chat, and he said, I've set this thing up called the Brexit Party. Do you want to stand as an MEP? And I said, yes. And so I stood as an MEP, and I had a brief stint in you know, as an MEP from July 2019 to January 2020.
All right. And what is the European Parliament like? I mean, it just looks like a big kid's playground, if you ask me.
That's exactly what it is. They can't initiate legislation. They can't repeal legislation. They can't hold the Commission. You know, the Commission is effectively the government of the European Union. They can't hold the Commission to account. You can't even speak for more than a minute or two. It's a complete waste of money. And it costs, in my estimate, costs about 2 billion euros a year to run that show. And it's a fig leaf of democracy to keep member states and their electorate subdued in the belief that there is some democracy at the European Union level. But there isn't. What you've got is an unelected commission that effectively does the bidding of France and Germany. So I was delighted to be out of the European Parliament, you know, by the time I left, because it, you know, it's just a big excuse for a party. And a huge crashing waste of money, fig leaf of democracy to hide the fact that it's France and Germany that call the shots. And, you know, we see that repeatedly. I don't want to get into a discussion on Brexit in particular, but, you know, you see that in all the policies that come out of the European Union. You know, when Angela Merkel says jump, they just say how high. Mm. To some extent, President Macron has the same effect, though, you know, I think his star is waning with France's economic plight. You know, France is in getting into deeper and deeper economic trouble. And I think this COVID-19 is going to be, it's going to be very revealing for the European Union because, you know, I was talking about sovereign debt crises earlier on, and I think you're going to have a sovereign debt crisis in Italy, which is not like Greece. You know, I think Greece was 4% of the GDP of the Eurozone. Italy is something like 20% of the GDP of the Eurozone.
Yeah, okay.
And you're going to have a sovereign debt crisis in Italy. You're going to have one in Spain, and you're probably going to have one in France. So it's going to be very interesting to see how they get out of that one.
All right, sounds it's an interesting part of your life. You can always talk about. You know, I was in the European Parliament for about 10 months. Yeah,
I'm still kind of Brexit engaged because, you know, and there's absolutely no reason why you should do. But if you read any of the stuff that I've written, you know, I think the withdrawal agreement is a terrible agreement, and the government perhaps, through political necessity, had to sign up to it just to get us out. But, you know, it signed us up into a whole host of other problems, which is going to be challenging for the Prime Minister to extricate himself from, particularly since they contradict his manifesto pledges. So, you know, I do bash on about it. And I've written lots of articles for The Telegraph and things, which you can probably get if you're, you know, if you can't sleep at night and you need time to put you to bed, that's one way to get to sleep.
there was one thing that I wanted to come on to, Ben. I don't know, it's maybe better to do this in a separate podcast because we're up on 40 minutes already, but you did mention it earlier, Ben, about sovereign debt. And also you obviously know an awful lot about the property market, which I'm sure will be very interesting. It's certainly interesting to me as a homeowner. Who's considering, you know, his options at the minute with what he wants to do in his future, but also to people who listen to the podcast. Everyone has a house, and most people do, and I'm sure they'll be very interested. But I have a feeling that is maybe best left to another podcast. I'm sure it's a subject on its own that we could discuss for a while.
Mark, do you want to ask Ben if he'd be up for the investor pitch? You'll better explain it than me.
Oh yeah, sure. Yes, what we sometimes do, Ben, is we ask our CEO guests to do a 60-second sort of director pitch, and it's really your chance to just pitch the company to potential investors why First Property Group is potentially a good investment or something they should look at. So if you would like to do that, I know we haven't warned you this was going to happen, but if you're up for that, then you know, you can go for it.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds great. Yeah, thank you, Mark.
So would you like me, no pressure, but I will
you
start.
You want me to do it now? Do the 1 minute now.
Yeah, I'll start the stopwatch. I'll count you down from three. Just keep an eye on the nearest clock or whatever, if you've got one. So in 3, 2, 1, off you go.
Well, First Property Group is a first-class company with operations in the UK, Poland, and Romania. I say it's first class because our track record is first class. We came through the last credit crunch with net asset value growth of 25% per annum. And we're going into the COVID-19 pandemic economic recession, cashed up with a secure portfolio of property worth about 700 million. We've got £25 million sitting on the balance sheet, which we can use for future deals and to bolster our portfolio where needs be. So even though the future is incredibly uncertain at the moment, if you're looking for a safe pair of hands to manage your wealth and to ensure that we come out of it with a sensible income stream on the way, First Property Group is your bet.
Excellent. That was very nice. Under 60 seconds and very, very direct. I like that one. Well done.
Hey, thank you. It comes from, actually, having to speak in the European Parliament and make sure you can do everything in under a minute.
Yeah, okay. That's good practice. Did have its uses then, in a sense. I just have one little question to finish. So investors can get exposure to you through, through obviously the share price listed on the stock exchange. But do you also have funds, did you say?
Yeah, so we have funds that we manage.
Yeah.
You have to typically be a high net worth individual before we can take your money, you know, for KYC reasons. But that's absolutely one way people can invest. And we've got no minimum amount of investment required. It's more a regulatory reason why they need to be high net worth.
Okay.
And the way to do that, Mark, if anyone's interested, is to contact Jeremy Barkas, who's our marketing director, and he's the gatekeeper to all our funds.
Okay.
And he can organize that.
Great. Well, listen, Ben, it's been fascinating talking to you. And as I say, I think we if you're up for it, I'd like to schedule another podcast where we can focus on sort of the property market and, as we said, the wider economic picture and sovereign debt and all those things. But
that'd be terrific.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed this talking to you today. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. I've enjoyed it. There's nothing I like more than the sound of my own voice. So.
No.
Thank you very much.
Ben, thanks, Ben.
Thank you very much. All the best. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from Fairbairn & Russell. Tune in next time when we'll have our second private investor and entrepreneur who now runs a listed company. His name's Darren Hazelwood, and we look forward to having a chat with him very soon. Tune in next time.